You're listening to an SBS News podcast.
America's decline is over.
For decades, our country has been looted, pillaged, raped, and plundered by nations near and far.
The Riviera of the Middle East, this could be something.
The biggest increase in the history of the stock market, that's pretty good.
I wiped out the paper straw a little time.
You're gambling with the lives of millions of people. You're gambling with World War III.
And we will make America great again.
Welcome to World News Weekly. They were just a few of Trump's most memorable moments over the course of his 100 days in office. I'm Katrina Stewart, and joining me is SBS World News journalist Claudia Farhart. Hi, Claudia.
Hello, Kat.
So, scrapping paper straws, Claudia, if that's not the United States' proudest achievement, I don't know what is.
Look, you've got to take the small wins, Kat, especially if your approval rating has slipped to 44%, but hopefully the shower pressure's okay.
We'll be talking about all of this with Dr. Emma Shortis from the Australia Institute shortly, and the latest updates from the Middle East with a new International Court of Justice hearing.
And speaking of the Trump effect, we'll take a look at how Mark Carney went from underdog to unlikely winner in Canada's election, but first, the latest on the shaky prospects for a deal to end the war in Ukraine.
I am glad to announce the signing of today's historic economic partnership agreement between the United States and Ukraine, establishing the United States-Ukraine Reconstruction Investment Fund. This partnership allows the United States to invest alongside Ukraine to unlock Ukraine's growth assets, mobilize American talent, capital, and governance standards that will improve Ukraine's investment climate and accelerate Ukraine's economic recovery.
That was U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent. The U.S. and Ukraine have just signed the minerals deal Trump has been pushing hard for. It's touted as a reconstruction fund, but didn't include any safety guarantees from the U.S. It still has to be formally approved by Ukraine's parliament, and we have yet to see if it gets Ukraine any closer to a more favourable ceasefire. Relations between Zelensky and Trump had already appeared to be on the mend. Many of us will have seen that striking photo this week of the two leaders sitting face-to-face on the sidelines of Pope Francis's funeral over the weekend, their first in-person meeting since their disastrous Oval Office talks in February ended in a very public argument. In an interview, Trump described the Vatican meeting as a moment of solace for all the civilians being killed in Ukraine, and seemed to turn against Putin, condemning Russia's strikes on Ukraine on his platform Truth Social, questioning whether the Russian president was, quote, just tapping me along.
And Trump used his social media platform for an astonishing bit of diplomacy, pleading with Putin in all caps to stop. Joining us now from London to wade through the morass of conflicting messaging is our chief international correspondent, Ben Lewis. Welcome back, Ben.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
Firstly, what do you make of this minerals deal? Is this the thing that will unblock US support for Ukraine?
Look, for Ukraine, it is a step in the right direction in securing US support. The Trump administration has said, look, one of the best ways to guarantee American protection is by having American companies, American workers digging up these rare earth minerals on Ukrainian territory. The idea being, you know, Russia wouldn't dare do something that could lead to American deaths. Now, that is an interesting theory, of course. It'll take a long time for many of these projects to get off the ground, and there's every chance there won't actually be American workers anywhere. However, it does give the United States direct financial investment in Ukraine, which should mean that the Trump administration continues to provide Ukraine with some support when there were doubts that it would. And if you look into the announcement itself, the language is quite strong for the Trump administration. I mean, showing a lot more solidarity with Ukraine than is usual. It talks about Russia's full-scale invasion, which is a phrase you never hear this White House using. And it also said that no one who benefited or financed or supplied the Russian war machine will be allowed to benefit from this reconstruction fund. This was a deal that was supposed to be signed back in February when Volodymyr Zelensky went to the Oval Office and there was that disastrous exchange between him, Donald Trump, and J.D. Vance. It seems that Ukraine has been holding out somewhat, trying to improve the conditions of this deal, And it appears to have worked. One key thing that we've seen from a draft of the agreement anyway, it showed that Ukraine secured the removal of any requirement for it to pay back the US for past military assistance. So any future military assistance will count as a contribution to this investment fund, but Ukraine is not going to have to pay back the military aid it has received in the past, which is a good thing for Ukraine because it's something, in reality, they're never going to be able to do.
And Putin has declared a three-day ceasefire, but Russia appears to be pushing its military campaign in Ukraine harder than ever. Are there any signs Russia is any closer to agreeing to a substantive deal?
At this stage, no. We don't know what's happening behind closed doors and what Vladimir Putin has said exactly to Steve Witkoff, President Trump's envoy to everything, including to Russia. This Victory Day ceasefire proposal does sound like the Kremlin is listening to what's coming out of the White House. Donald Trump saying, you know, it is time for Vladimir Putin to make a deal. Vladimir, stop the attacks on civilian areas, that sort of thing. So it looks like it's a nod and a wink to that without committing to anything more permanent. Now, the Ukrainians, of course, say this is nonsense. We're ready for 30 days at least, happy to do an indefinite ceasefire if we can start proper negotiations. Chatting to some Ukrainian friends in Kyiv connected to the government recently over the last few days, they think there's a chance that this ceasefire has been called simply because the Kremlin is terrified something is going to happen during the Victory Day parade in Moscow. Now, that seems a little bit, you know, outlandish, extreme. There are big air defences around Moscow, that sort of thing. But we've seen Ukraine send drones to the Russian capital before. It could happen again just a few days ago. It appears that Ukrainian Special Services killed a senior Russian military figure in Moscow. So there is real fear in Russia that Vladimir Putin's big moment, his Victory Day parade inviting various world leaders, the ones who'll turn up, could be ruined by Ukraine, and this could just be a way to try and ensure safety for that event.
Thanks so much for getting up at the crack of dawn to talk us through all of that, Ben.
No worries. There is nothing I would rather do at 7 a.m.
After 100 days back in the White House, America is a free, proud, and sovereign nation once more, and our magnificent destiny is closer than ever before. It's closer than ever before. You have no idea how close it is. Our golden age has only just begun. What the world has witnessed in the past 14 weeks is a revolution of common sense.
100 days as president, can you believe it? In classic Trump style, it was marked by a rally in Michigan and featured all the usual elements of a Trump rally, mocking his opposition, attacking former President Joe Biden, and condemning those attempting to hold his power to account, who he described as communist radical left judges. He described his presidency so far as the golden age of America and the revolution of common sense, as we just heard. And of course, it wouldn't be a Trump rally without his tagline, cries of fake news, in reference this time to polls indicating his rapidly declining popularity.
His first 100 days have been marked by seismic shifts around the world, unravelling the global order America has lauded since World War II. He's threatening to annex other nations by force, launching a global tariff war, and redrawing America's alliances. Joining us now to talk through all the highs and lows is one of the Australia Institute's resident US experts, Emma Shortis. Welcome to the pod, Emma.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Emma, you've been following this presidency the whole way. What do you see as the defining moments so far?
I mean, it's always hard to get a handle on them, isn't it, Claudia? Because, you know, the flood of news from the Trump administration is so relentless. But a few moments do stand out to me. One fairly recently when the FBI under the newly appointed head, Kash Patel, arrested a judge for what they described as obstructing justice, obstructing their access to an immigrant that they were attempting to deport. And I think the arrest of the judge in the context of the brazen attacks of the Trump administration against the rule of law, both at home and internationally, was a moment that really stood out to me amongst a number of tests of those systems. And I think that's what the Trump administration has been doing in this 100 days, is testing weaknesses in the American democratic system, in the American system of in the American legal system and finding weaknesses and exploiting them.
And despite Trump saying this has been the most successful first 100 days of any presidency, he's also got the lowest 100-day approval rating since polling began 80 years ago. And it seems like conflict has been rife even in his inner circle. Are those polls really that bad given the turmoil he's unleashed? And what do you think all this means for the next year or so ahead of those midterm elections?
I mean, I think those polls are not surprising, you know, given the chaos that the Trump administration is causing across the United States, you know, given the fact that it hasn't really addressed inflation as it promised it would. You know, Trump was always going to suffer in the polls for that reason. But I think we risk getting stuck in old assumptions about how politics functions in the United States if we think that that immediately means that Trump, there will be political consequences for Trump. You know, Trump is so effective at redirecting blame. His base is so rusted on that it's not clear to me that, you know, the political consequences will appear at the midterm elections, for example, which is still 18 months away. You know, so much can happen between now and then. And the Republican Party at the federal and state level has been engaged in a long time in voter repression and in eroding voting rights and access to voting for millions of Americans. And so I think predicting the outcomes of the midterms or the consequences for Trump over the next few years is very difficult and not at all straightforward in ways we're accustomed to assuming.
What about the Democrats, Emma? Where have they and their billionaire backers been during all of this?
The Democrats, I think, are still in disarray, which is a real indictment, I think, of the party. You know, they really fell apart, I think, after Kamala Harris's loss and have been struggling to collect themselves and I think struggling to unite around opposition to Trump. I think the party is torn between two opposing ideas that see, you know, one that sees Trump as temporary and, you know, that politics as usual is the way to get through this by picking battles, for example, and another one that sees Trump as the existential threat that the Democratic Party actually painted him as during the campaign. And those factions are really, I think, fighting with each other rather than uniting around opposition to Trump. And that is really hurting the Democrats when there is clearly an appetite in the United States for concerted leadership. You know, there's a reason that Senator Bernie Sanders and Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez are getting tens of thousands of people to their rallies because there's an appetite for this kind of leadership. And the Democratic Party as a whole, I think, is really failing to capitalize on that and failing to oppose the worst excesses of the Trump administration.
Do you think this could be part of the Democrats' tactics to sort of let Trump go loose and not intervene at all and let him sort of destroy himself?
I think there is an argument or there is an argument happening in the party about letting him do that, you know, letting him tank in the polls and just waiting it out. But I think there are opposition to that idea sits around, you know, not assuming that this is politics as usual or that Trump will go easily. And, you know, when Trump has Congress and the executive and the Supreme Court, I think there's a pretty strong argument that just waiting him out is a pretty risky strategy.
Thanks so much for unpacking that busy timeline of Trump's first 100 days with us, Emma.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
When I sit down with President Trump, it will be to discuss the future economic and security relationship between two sovereign nations. And it will be with our full knowledge that we have many, many other options than the United States to build prosperity for all Canadians.
Strong words from Canada's Prime Minister Mark Carney there. A great example of Trump's influence being felt beyond the US's borders is the astonishing election victory of Canada's left-leaning Liberal Party under Mark Carney, falling just 3 seats short of a majority. Trump's tariffs, repeated jibes and threats to make them the 51st state turned Canada's politics on its head. The former central bank governor and political newcomer, Carney, quickly positioned himself as a defender of Canada's freedom and a strong economic manager amid an uncertain global environment. Meanwhile, his conservative opposition, Pierre Poilievre, not only lost the election, but also his own seat, which he had held for 20 years. Poilievre was hamstrung by having previously adopted much of the Trump rhetoric, even using the slogan Canada First. So quite an upset for the conservatives, who were expecting a return to power for the first time in over a decade. Carney campaigned on standing up to Donald Trump. He'll now have to do it. What's that going to look like?
Well, the two leaders have already spoken on the phone. Trump congratulated Carney on his win, so a possible sign maybe that political pragmatism might now set in. But Carney is insisting he's going to be approaching this from a position of strength and that Canada is only going to enter any kind of conversation with the US on its own terms. And it looks like he's in no rush to do that, really. He's already said he'll only go to Washington if and when there's a serious discussion to be had, and only if the US shows it can respect Canada's sovereignty first. So it might suit Carney better to just delay a little bit on this one. We've just spoken about what's going on in the US and the internal pressure Trump is now facing, you know, as well from his own support base over this trade war. The pressure is really on him, on Trump, in the lead up to the midterm elections rather than on Carney. I mean, that's not to say Carney can just sit back and do nothing now. He did promise to stand up to Trump, and now he's going to be facing pressure of his own to actually follow through and do that, particularly if he's in a minority government. The big challenge, I think, is going to be balancing the need to do some kind of deal with the US, which is, you know, Canada's biggest trading partner by far, with that image of defiance and national pride that won him this election in the first place. Analysts are already warning Carney can't just take the bait every time Trump tries to taunt him with this 51st state comment. And, you know, we can be sure that he'll continue to do that, even if it's half jokingly. He's going to have to focus on the bigger picture now. The first test of that might come next month when Canada's hosting the G7 in Alberta. Trump is expected to attend that one, so they'll likely have to go face-to-face then, and no doubt the rest of the world will be watching to see how it goes.
And could this be a turning of the tide in what's been a fairly right-facing political momentum around the world? Does this become the example, say, of how left-leaning politics can win?
I'm sure that's the question our own Labor Party has been asking in the lead up to this weekend's vote. Although, you know, Albanese's been nowhere near as explicit in his disapproval of Donald Trump as Mark Carney was. But yes, this result is very much an outlier in recent elections globally, where we've seen, you know, a pretty clear push to the right in Europe, in South America, in the US, obviously, and a clear push against incumbent parties in particular. So Carney's now the first leader to be elected on this explicit anti-Trump platform, which proved to be enormously successful. Is that going to set a blueprint for how other centre-left parties can do the same? It's unlikely because, for one, Carney's political novelty meant he could distance himself from his predecessor's terrible ratings and, you know, hate to be crass, Kat, but they're not all going to have the great fortune of being threatened with annexation by the US president. This wasn't just like a general dislike of Donald Trump. Canada's circumstances were very, very specific, not just the threat of being turned into the 51st state, but given the US accounted for 2/3 of Canada's exports, the tariffs were arguably just as much of an existential threat. So can you replicate those results when the stakes are lower? Well, we'll have to wait and see. The bigger lesson may actually be for centre-right parties around the world. Try to replicate the success of the MAGA movement, and you may just end up like Pierre Poilievre.
As I address you today, the Palestinian people are being starved, bombed, and forcibly displaced by Israel, their unlawful occupier. Death looms large.
The ICJ is becoming completely politicized. Legal means are being used time and again to promote the Palestinians' political agenda.
That was Amar Hijazi, the Palestinian ambassador to the Netherlands, and Gideon Saar, Israel's foreign minister. They were speaking as the International Court of Justice opened its hearing on Israel's responsibilities for the humanitarian crisis crippling Gaza. No aid has entered the Strip since March 2, when Israel cut off all supplies after the ceasefire deal collapsed. So the blockade has now surpassed 60 days, leading the UN to warn of full-scale famine conditions across the Strip. Israel has categorically denied the allegations and refused to participate in the hearings. Claudia, what can we expect from this process?
So the ICJ is assessing Israel's responsibility for ensuring essential supplies get into Gaza and whether it can actually ban the UN's relief agency, UNRWA. They'll be hearing from about 40 nations and organisations. These hearings will go on for 5 days, but the court will likely take months and months to form an opinion, and even then it's not going to be legally binding or enforceable. So other than adding to this bigger picture of international pressure on Israel to reverse its total aid blockade that you mentioned, which Israel has so far ignored, the court likely won't be able to deliver any immediate relief to Palestinians in Gaza.
There's also been some effort to restart ceasefire talks in Cairo this week. Has anything come from that?
There was some hope earlier in the week when two Egyptian security sources told the Reuters news agency that there'd been a significant breakthrough. We knew Arab mediators had been pushing for a 5-year ceasefire deal, and Hamas had actually indicated it would agree to release all the remaining hostages in one go if Israel would agree to that 5-year deal. But both Israel and Hamas have since come out and said those reports of progress were completely false. It now looks like, Kat, the two sides have locked into these fundamentally incompatible positions. On one hand, we've got Hamas saying they'll no longer entertain any short-term partial ceasefires, given they've done that already and the deal collapsed in phase one. And then on the other hand, Israel saying it will never agree to a 5-year deal because that would just allow Hamas to regroup, rearm and launch another October 7 style attack on Israel. So after 19 months of war, it's now looking like a deal is less likely than ever. This week, we've also seen renewed Israeli strikes on the Lebanese capital and in Syria, where it says it targeted a group that attacked the Druze community after days of sectarian violence near Damascus that have reportedly killed dozens of people. So once again, we're seeing Israeli strikes on multiple fronts across this region.
And it's no secret there's been a lot of internal division in Israel over the course of this war, but that seems to be heating up as well this week, with news Israel's spy chief has announced he'll step down in June after the prime minister tried to sack him. What's going on there?
Yeah, this is turning into arguably one of the biggest challenges for Netanyahu to date. This all came out into the open in March when the Shin Bet, headed by Ronen Bar, released its report into the security failures of October 7. And the Shin Bet admitted its own mistakes, but it also took aim at the Netanyahu government for allowing massive Hamas military buildup by maintaining this long-held policy of calm with Hamas. Netanyahu, who was the prime minister for 13 of the 15 years in the lead-up to October 7, and who was already accused of propping them up to keep the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank weak, has taken issue with that. Around the same time, it comes out that Ronen Bar authorised investigations into two of Netanyahu's closest aides over allegations they took payments from Qatar to promote Qatar's interests in Israel. At the same time, many within Israel believe that Qatar was also financing Hamas in Gaza, so a massive conflict there. At that point, Netanyahu and his cabinet vote to fire Bar in late March, and that's where it got really interesting, Kat, because Bar decided to challenge his sacking in court, and all kinds of scandals have come out in the meantime. In an affidavit to the Supreme Court, Bar has since accused Netanyahu of ordering the Shin Bet to conduct surveillance on Israeli anti-war protesters, Israeli citizens, which he says he refused to do, of pressuring Bar, to sign a security assessment that would allow Netanyahu to avoid fronting court in his corruption trial, and telling him that in the case of a constitutional crisis, Bar's loyalty has to be to the prime minister and not to the courts. And remember, before this war, before October 7, Netanyahu was already trying to reform the judiciary so that he could have greater control over court appointments. Netanyahu's team immediately hit back. They dismissed all of that as a complete lie, and Bar now says he's going to leave his job on June 15. But that's likely not going to be the end of this crisis for Netanyahu.
And as always, a quick whip around the globe to flag some other big stories this week. Tensions between China and the Philippines have flared again in the South China Sea, with both sides becoming engaged in what's being called a war of selfies. The focus of the latest dispute is Sandy Cay, a tiny sandbar. Earlier this month, members of the Chinese Coast Guard landed on the reef, rolled out a flag and posed for photos, saying they were exercising their sovereign jurisdiction over the reef.
In retaliation, the Philippines sent its own personnel to Sandy Cay, taking photos with their own national flag. The standoff was happening days after the US and the Philippines launched their annual joint military drills in the Philippines, which China says undermine regional stability. Spain and Portugal have seen the light once again after the worst blackouts in their history, which affected some 55 million people. Traffic lights are back on, trains and metro services have resumed after a sudden outage saw 60% of supply in Spain drop off in 5 seconds, and a state of emergency was declared as well.
Both countries have ruled out a cyber attack but are conducting independent audits to investigate what happened. Some are blaming renewables, as the two countries have high levels of wind and solar on their electricity grid, as sudden fluctuations in weather can cause problems. But other experts suggest the scale of the outage makes renewables an unlikely cause. At least 68 African migrants were reportedly killed in a US strike on a detention centre in Yemen, according to Houthi-run media. The alleged attack is one of the deadliest so far since the US launched Operation Rough Rider on March 15, intensifying airstrikes against the Houthis.
The UN says hundreds of thousands of migrants, primarily from Ethiopia and Somalia, embark on the dangerous journey through Djibouti and Yemen each year, with the aim of reaching Gulf nations like Saudi Arabia. And last year, the number of migrants to have taken that route was close to 500,000.
Forget about it, Homer. You made it to the top. You're the coolest dad ever.
Thanks, Bart. That makes it all worthwhile.
Is that your wallet?
Don't!
There's truly a Simpsons reference for every scenario, except, unlike Homer, who did not scale back up the mountain to retrieve his wallet, one tourist in Japan has been airlifted from the peaks of Mount Fuji for the second time in 4 days after he went back up for his phone. Our reliance on those devices has been taken to a whole new level, if you get what I mean.
No amount of shame from the 27-year-old's first rescue could deter him from another 3,000-metre ascent, Kat. Wow. His first call for help came after he lost his crampons. They're the spiky things on the bottom of your boots for any
essential
non-hikers out there. And this phone retrieval led to his hospitalisation from altitude sickness. Climbers behaving badly, Kat.
So ending on a PSA to any prospective climbers, don't go back for your phone. It's not worth it. And on that note, that's The World This Week. Be sure to like and subscribe to The World News Weekly podcast. New episodes will drop every Friday. And as always, you can live stream the SBS World News Bulletin from 6:30 p.m. every night or anytime by going to SBS On Demand. Claudia, see you next time.
See you then.